The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Vettler. With me today in the studio, I have Emma Barr.
Hello.
Hi, Emma. And then, good Lord, I don't know what just happened. Coming to us from the internet, we have Albert Pedroza.
Hello.
Yeah, it's still an audio podcast. We have Nicole Hines. Nicole Hines.
This is a good start.
I'm kicking butt podcasting wise today. And we have Holly Conger.
Hey there.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about a touchy subject, a subject that before the show, Nicole said she was a little nervous about. A little nervous?
Calling me out.
You a little nervous, Nicole?
I'm a little nervous. I'm always a little nervous, though.
It's fine. We're going to talk about personality. We're going to be, is being smart, technically proficient, hardworking enough when it comes to a career in medicine? I don't want to broaden it to personality. Because I feel like that is like, okay, or will your personality kill your chances at a career as a physician? Now, the answer is no. But I want to talk about the kinds of personalities that make your life more difficult in achieving that goal. But first, I do want to say, and this is something I've been wanting to say for a while on the show, and I haven't really known how. But that is, there is some shit going down in America, and I wish I could help. But all I have is this podcast. In my wildest dreams, you have the support you need to lead a life of your choosing. You deserve to be happy, healthy, and successful in whatever ways you define those words. So if you need support because you experience racism, discrimination, harassment, mental health crisis, I want you to be able to get the help you need. And so I'm going to put some links in the show notes from now on to some resources. But the bottom line is that, for what it's worth, I see you. I wish I could do more. And maybe I can, in ways that I don't understand yet or know about yet. But I see you, and I'm glad you're here, and other people are too. Thank you. Listener feedback from Kalman about assistant physicians or associate physicians. So Kalman is working towards a nursing degree with an eye on medical school someday. He heard us talking about students who didn't match and knows someone who wasn't successful on her first try. Fortunately, she was successful on her second try. So, but our discussion resonated with Kalman because of that. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. He points out that the states of Missouri, Arkansas, Utah, and Kansas have started licensing a new form of provider called an AP or GRP. I'm not sure what GRP stands for, but AP, I think, is assistant physician. He says these are medical school graduates who take step two and get boarded to practice in a legal framework virtually identical to physician assistants, which is something we're more familiar with. He said he contacted his state rep and she was willing to attempt to pass it where he is. And several other states are working on this as well. And I'll add verbatim what he said. I'd say medical schools and medical students should lobby for these laws as well as raise awareness that such programs exist, because they seem to be the best kept secret in medical education. Almost every year, at least one M4 commits suicide after failing to match. If we can soften the blow just a little, we can save careers, save mental health, and perhaps even save some lives. So yeah, Arkansas, Kansas, Utah, and Missouri. And so I did a little research. We've talked about this on the show before. I did a little research. Arkansas, these folks practice under the supervision of a physician. I think there is a naming problem here. I think associate physician or assistant physician sounds too much like physician assistant.
Yeah.
I would suggest associate MD. How about that?
Sounds good.
Associate MD.
Do these people like go into that job working like with the idea of doing it for a year and applying again?
Well, this is what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe. I think that's possible. I think there should be a path going forward from MD into a full-fledged independent physician. So say after X years of call it associate MD hood, or you could do your job hunt outside the match just like normal people do. What do you think about that?
Well, I feel like if you say you have to do X number of years before you become like a like board certified, that's basically just residency.
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm down with that.
But then you have to have regulations over like, did you see this many kinds of patients and that kind of stuff.
So are you recommending people?
I am recommending
apply for. Okay, sorry. With what you just said, were you saying people apply for these while they're also applying for the match, or after they don't match, then they look for these positions?
No, I think probably the default should be matching, and the reason I think this is because actually the match success rate is actually pretty high. Most people, at least, you know, like above 90% of people, I think it's like 94% of people nationally find their match. And we do a little bit better than that. Actually, we do pretty well. So I think that's how the default should be. But I also feel that we should have a path forward in some way. And this kind of struck me as like, well, if you provide that path, the AAMC, for instance, disagrees with this whole idea. They cite patient safety. And I know among physicians, it's a controversial plan. And maybe Holly has thoughts about that now that she's almost a physician. I'm willing to bet that Holly does have thoughts.
I do.
Yeah, go ahead. What are your thoughts?
Well, I guess I'm confused as to what this purpose would be, because I know that there's usually two groups of people who don't match. There's those who were, you know, great applicants going for a very competitive specialty that don't match, that can very easily soap into something else or do a prelim year and apply again or take a research year to go for that super competitive thing again. Or there's people who weren't going for anything competitive and for whatever reason that may be, whether they have a red flag on their app or interview terribly or whatever it is, don't match even in a non-competitive specialty. And I think those are the people that maybe this is aimed at, because I think it's normal to try and soap. And so like the not match rate, I don't know if that counts people who had to soap or not, or if it's just straight up didn't match ever.
Yeah.
After the soap or not.
Well, again, I think this is an alternate path for people who, okay, so here's the thing. If you have an MD and you can pass step exams and your only roadblock to getting hired for a residency position is, well, and your only roadblock is getting hired to be a resident because the system trains several thousand people more than it can handle every year. I think that's what I'm aiming for.
Yeah, I was like, there are fewer applicants than spots, so I don't think that's
true. Yeah, there's a lot of spots that go unfilled every single year.
But why is that? Is it because did they give up? I mean, this is what I don't understand. Like, did those programs could fill their positions if they wanted to?
I think so, but I think the issue is with the whole matching process, with the whole algorithm, and then I don't think there's anything set in place for the ones who don't match besides the soap. So there's soap and then there's nothing else after soap.
Yes.
And then those spots go unfilled.
But again, why do they go unfilled? You can match outside soap after soap is complete. That is a thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. But people don't.
Is it a lack of interest in that specific field? Like, even if you don't match, but you're given just the one field that you absolutely don't want to go into?
Well, I mean, that's possible.
I don't think so, because there's a lot of specialties that go that have spots that are unfilled. It's not just a few.
Yeah.
Like family medicine and internal medicine, psychiatry, I think, are the ones that always have spots. But like ER, the surgical subspecialties, like usually they have none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are certain that don't have any problem filling their positions. But also there are people who want to go into positions that just don't have that. They don't make it in because the numbers aren't there for them. And what I'm saying is that perhaps students are making choices about their specialty that are unrealistic, maybe. I think that's possible. But I also think that, you know, the other problem with soap is that the more times you go through it, i.e. more than once, the less likely you are to match the next year.
Do you mean like each round during the soap week?
No. If you go through it next year,
again, year.
Your chances drop by tens of percent.
Yeah.
Because it looks like a black mark. And I don't like it. I just don't like it. I think the whole system is weird. I mean, like, we are on a personal level, and after 18 years of doing this, like, sometimes match looks like I don't know, I'm used to the concept, but everybody else who looks at this is like, what in the world?
It's a very weird process.
It's a very
for sure very anxiety provoking, even when it goes your way, even when it turns out well. It's super stressful.
It's just weird. It's just a weird situation. I mean, on the one hand, it's nice because, you know, 95% of people get a position, but then there are those people who it's kind of a mystery as to why they didn't get a position, and they're kind of screwed. a little bit.
So were you saying that programs can see how many times an applicant goes through the soap?
I believe that that is true.
Well, they could tell that they're a reapplicant, probably.
Yes. Yes. Now, okay, so I know there are a lot of edge cases. I know this is a weird idea that I've had, but, you know, I don't feel like it's necessarily a safety issue as the AAMC fears.
I guess my question would be, like, let me finish. Career goal for that person?
I mean, I don't know.
Are they going to go to residency?
My goal is either for them ultimately is a career in the thing that they spent $300,000 doing and which they are competent to do based on the fact that they're graduating from medical school and they passed the licensing exams. If that's what the bar is for being safe enough to practice medicine, to being knowledgeable enough to practice medicine, they have achieved those things. The only thing they didn't achieve was getting a job after med school. And the stakes in that situation are so high to me that we as an industry, I guess, as a system, I feel like we should be providing them with a backup plan. No, Holly's so not buying this. Holly has never bought anything less than what I am saying now.
Well, I guess to play devil's advocate, on the flip side, you know, if someone is not matching multiple times, you know, I would question why, you know, and I would question, like, is that someone that I would want to take care of my family member? Like, is there something coming out in this whole process that's like a big red flag?
Possibly, but it's also possible that it's just bad luck. I mean, once you don't match once, that is enough to plummet your chances by a certain number of points, right?
Well, I think it'll
every time you have to apply, but
it also has to do with, for example, let's say you have somebody who applies to 10 different places and they only rank 10 places. I mean, the chances of them not matching is higher than somebody who, let's say, applies to 40 places.
Yes. Yeah. You can make mistakes.
Yeah.
In how you rank people.
Exactly.
And the mistake that you could make is, I mean, basically we tell people during the match, you're like, you have to rank enough spaces, enough programs to make sure that you match. That is your goal. Soap is not a backup plan. And so we tell people that. And invariably, some people are specific enough in their wants and needs to have that be a problem for them. And so, yeah, I understand that. I know that there are a lot of reasons why somebody might not match. But the reason I don't like is the chance part of it. I just want people to be happy. I want people to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, I want people after they've spent $300,000 and invested so much money and so much time and so much energy, I want people to have something for it.
I have two thoughts. So one of them, you're saying that, like, once you take your step exams and you graduate from medical school, you're like a qualified doctor, but that's not really true.
I'm saying is that you're qualified to be a resident.
Right.
So you're qualified. I mean, assuming that this idea gets enacted. Mm-hmm. You are qualified to be an associate MD,
right,
whatever you want to call it, and you are qualified to practice under the supervision of a resident,
right,
of a physician who may not be part of a residency program, but who is nevertheless a physician.
Right. But then if you take that to employers, like, that's not associated with a residency program, they're not used to, like, they may not be used to having that. So that would be a barrier, too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, you propose this, you make it, and it happens overnight.
I guess I would wonder, like, how do you get them licensed and how do you get them insured? Because
you graduated from med school, but
you didn't go to residency, and it creates this weird, you're not board certified, you never trained, like, what can you do?
Yeah. I think that's the intent of these laws in these, you know, four and perhaps growing number of states that are looking into this.
I guess the problems with it are just, if you dropped a fourth year med student, which is basically what somebody who didn't match is, into a hospital and said, go. You know, they can't do anything. You need residency to teach you how to do whatever it is. And so, like,
it absolutely wouldn't work that way.
Struggling to imagine a path where they can just, like, be a pseudo physician. I guess I just, like, don't know what their role would be.
Yeah. Well, I think what Dave is saying is that you'd have sort of like an apprenticeship.
Yes, actually, that's a better way of putting what I've said.
Yeah, where you, for example, like somebody who you don't necessarily have to go to college to become an electrician, they have a program where you work under an electrician for 2-4 years, and then after that certain amount of time, they basically say, okay, you were supposed to learn everything you needed to become an electrician. And I think that's what Dave is saying, right, Dave? Like, you work under a physician, and then after a certain amount of years, you would be said to, it would be said that you're competent to be a physician.
I think that's exactly what I'm saying. And said ever so much better than what I said. I know that people would have difficulties with the comparison between, you know, an electrician and a and a doctor or something like that. I understand that. But conceptually, that's what residency is anyway. A residency is an apprenticeship model. It's just not called that. And the other problem with my idea is that residency is also very structured, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, there are things that you can do as a second year that you're not doing as an intern. And then there are the classes and things like that. So I know there's a lot of details to work out. I just want people to be happy. I want people to leave here. I want everybody to leave here with prospects and not have to wait an entire year or more before achieving their life's ambition. I don't like it.
I agree. And I think that, I mean, there's like weird consulting jobs and other things that you could do, but usually the best path is to go to residency. I guess I would just be concerned if you just like eat all of the regulation of residency and all of the training requirements and careful planning to make sure you're competent, you know, like that would be very scary to me. So like letting someone just like avoid that whole path and still hold the same title and responsibilities would frighten me.
I'm not arguing that there isn't structure. I'm just arguing for an additional path that puts them on the road to, and maybe when I say achieving their dream, I'm arguing to put them on a path that will allow them to approximate something of what they imagined their life would be. Like, let's be honest. Nobody in this world, most people don't achieve their life dreams. You know, like it's just not a thing. You know, so I guess nobody has the right to achieve their dream. But if you work really hard and you're a good person and you embody the ideas and it just doesn't work out for you, especially after you've paid, you know, so much money and so much time and so much effort, it doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough. I have a whole another. I'm going to give myself the last word because you have all had come up with very reasonable objections to my plan, but I still like my plan.
You're making me feel like a bah humbug over here, but I was just like, I don't know, that's too concerned.
I love you, Holly. Let's see.
No, I was actually listening. I have one more word.
Wait a minute.
It's not, it doesn't have to do with that specific idea. I was listening to a podcast on how to give your elevator speech on like a project proposal or whatever.
Yeah.
So I feel like you just gave us your elevator speech and we're giving you feedback.
Yes.
And you're not supposed to wait too long into your like planning period before introducing the idea to other people, because then you get too attached to the idea.
Okay.
But you also don't want to introduce it too early, because then you might not have some thoughts, you know.
I have. So what you're saying is that I perhaps have introduced this idea too early.
Maybe a little bit.
Appreciate that. That is excellent. It's all been great feedback. Like,
okay.
Like, as I said, you all have said reasonable things to me about why this is, if not impossible, at least there are problems that need to be worked out.
Right. Now you can go work on it and then come back to us.
All right. I will add this to, what was I supposed to do last week? There was something I was supposed to fix last week. I can't remember what it was.
This headphones?
No.
Only one word sometimes.
I can't even fix the headphones. How am I supposed to fix medical education? This is not good.
I know it's like licensing. Each state sets their rules for how many times you can fail a board exam and still be licensed. And yes. So sometimes I think that is what gets in the way of certain people. Because if you fail step one more than twice, you lose a lot of states that you can even be a doctor in. If you fail it three times, it's even more. You know, like, there's a lot of nuance in there, I think.
Yes, yes.
And I was like, that's cool.
All right, let's shift gears for a minute because I want to talk about something else that affects your career. I want to talk about effective presence. Do you know what effective presence is? I did not know what effective presence is until this week. Anybody, any ideas? Did you read the article?
I read the article, yeah.
I think you could explain it best, Dave.
All right. Effective presence is the consistent and stable feelings that an individual tends to leave in their interaction partners. This is an interpersonal trait because it is defined by the experiences of the interaction partners rather than by those of the focal person, which means that you can't judge this on your own. Or you might not be able to judge this on your own. I worry that some people enter medical school with personalities that will make it tough for them to get a residency position or to achieve everything they want to in their careers. And, you know, so one of my questions, you know, was effective presence a factor in the 2021 match? And, you know, who knows? There's no way for me to know whether that's true or not. But I do know that there was some decrease in certain categories of people applying to the match in their success. And maybe one of the problems that people are talking about is students spent more time doing clerkships in their own institutions while institutions were trying to protect their own, because they couldn't go away for match for a residency.
Away rotation?
They couldn't go away for away rotation. Good Lord.
Or residency interviews.
They couldn't go away for away rotations. And so they had to spend all their time in their home institutions. And for some people, and so that meant that students had more opportunities to impress their home institutions, specialty decision makers, or the opposite, or not. So even though some think that home institutions protected their own by ranking people they knew more highly, it's possible that overexposure hurt some people who didn't deserve that outcome. So that's my thesis. Thoughts so far?
So I was wondering,
I'm looking, you know, like Holly, for some reason, is I'm gonna on the live stream, I'm gonna turn on grid view again, because Holly is the only one looking at me, and I feel like after the first topic today, Holly's face basically is saying, "Dave, shut up."
What? I wasn't trying to say that with my face.
Well, now I'm reading into everything, Holly, into Holly's every expression change.
Have RBS. Is she using her eyebrow today?
She's using her eyebrows very expressively.
I don't want to receive that comment again.
Sorry, Emma.
When I was reading the popular article, not the actual manuscript, yes, it seemed like they focused on the negative aspect of
effective presence.
And they were saying, like, you know, you can annoy people and...
Yes.
And things like that. But then when I looked at the manuscript or the study that you sent us, I didn't read all of it. It was like 54 pages. But it seemed like they were talking more about it can be a positive thing or a negative thing.
It absolutely can be. Of course, you know, if you, and that's the point, right? If you walk into a room and people want to interact with you, you probably have, and they know you, you probably already have a positive affective presence. But there are people, and I think we know people, we can probably each, you know, sort of think of people that we know in our lives who on occasion you're like, or maybe the instant they walk into a room, you're like, you know, like, I like you and all.
But I wish you weren't here right now.
But I, you know, yeah, exactly. Whereas there are other people in your life who walk into a room and no matter what you're doing, you're happy to see them. You're happy for the interruption or whatever circumstance there was.
But I'm also wondering, are they also talking about, you know, those kinds of people that can walk into a room and like whatever their emotion is, like it kind of spreads throughout the room. Like if they're happy, everyone else can be happy. But if they're like having a bad day and grumpy, then everybody else is kind of grumpy.
I don't think that's what it really is, because there was a line in there that said like some people could be like super depressed, but mm-hmm. they'll be the positive kind of effective presence.
Okay. So yeah, it's more constant, like a constant negative or a constant
stable
negative.
Feelings.
Yeah.
According to the definition that I read, consistent and stable feelings.
I've met people before that just like, I don't know what it is, but they irritate me. And I've also met people that I just like really enjoy being around. But those people I don't think are always the same for everyone, you know, like, so I might find somebody annoying, but you might think they're great, you know? And so I was wondering, like, how consistent is this across?
I did read something that said that maybe it was the popular article that I posted that said that research seems to say that those feelings are more or less stable across people too. So it's, so that the same person that you might feel positive about, other people also feel positive about. But of course, that's not 100% true. I mean,
I think with the people that come to mind for me, it definitely seems to be more of that stable feeling that just everybody around kind of gets that energy from them.
Is effective presence essentially charisma is what, right?
That's what I was going to say. It's like, I think if you're like a compelling person or like a good leader, like you're, you know, you can woo people.
But there are people who, I guess so. I mean, charisma, I feel like charisma has a connotation for me that is more about public versus private. But maybe
really?
that's a false, like if you have charisma, you know, if you say somebody has charisma, often you're referring to their sort of like on stage personality kind of thing, but maybe that's bullshit. I don't know. I'm not going to say you're wrong. I don't know.
I think it might kind of be like social intelligence or like self-awareness type thing.
Yeah.
Because the memories I have interacting with the people who come to mind, it's like I would be talking with somebody and they would just out of nowhere appear and decide that they were hanging out with us. Yeah. And they wouldn't get the signals that they weren't really welcome.
emotional intelligence is super relevant.
Exactly. So I was thinking about like, so the problem, as I tried to point out before, the problem is you can't tell. Or if you're, let me put it this way. Unless you really think about it, it's hard to tell what your effect is on other people in this way. So you really have to pay attention. You know, you have to, you know, how do you know how you affect other people? I mean, you have to watch what people do when you talk to them for more than a couple of minutes. If they start doing other things, if they start looking at their phone, if they start, you know, clicking their computer mouse or whatever, there's one of two things that is going on. Either you interrupted them and they have something that they really need to get done, or they may be wishing that the conversation is over. The effect is the same. You know, either way, that's a strong hint to go, hey, look, great talking to you. I got to go.
When I said I was nervous at the beginning, something instantly came to mind. This is kind of where it lies. And it's that, like, you can't tell whether you have that positive or negative, but if you have like really bad anxiety or insecurity and you already constantly think or are self-critical in any situation that you're in and you think, oh, all these people hate me, they're judging everything I said, when in reality they like you.
That is such a good point.
What impact does that have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is such a good point.
I would actually disagree that you wouldn't be able to know what sort of presence you have, because let's say you have people constantly telling you like, oh, you know, good job, like these people like you, or like we like you, we want you to come back around. Like, that's essentially you're getting feedback from somebody. They're telling you like, hey, I enjoyed either our conversation or whatever. And so I think people give feedback, don't they?
Yeah, but not your mom. We're not talking about your mom, Albert.
That validation doesn't always come, and it doesn't always come at the right times.
Exactly. Like, I've had clinical experiences where I'm working with a team and I interpret silence or like no feedback as like I'm doing a bad job. Like, mm-hmm. I'm automatically self-critical. And then I find out, you know, a few days later when I ask for feedback, they're like, no, you're doing great. Like, you know, this is awesome. All this like positive stuff. I'm like, why didn't you tell me? Like, I've been thinking I'm doing wrong the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, this is why it's really hard to know, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell. I mean, you have to ask, which is why you ask, you know, this is why you
ask. If you ask, that's a little bit weird.
Like, yeah, because it's like your personality. There's only so much you can change.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, there are people that you could ask, right? You could pay for a coach if you wanted to do that. I mean, that's an extreme possibility, right?
What, do they like follow you around and ask people for
They're
you?
Just gonna hype you up.
No, but I mean, they could help you figure it out. They could help you, like, for instance, say, you know, well, what do people do when you talk to them for more than minutes? Do they start clicking their computer mouse? That's, I mean, like, you could ask your mentors, but again, you know, I know what you're going to say, which is that, you know, they're not always probably willing to say, well, you know, you're kind of annoying.
I kind of don't like you, but I also can't tell you how to fix it. I think that, like, evals are where this is relevant for medical school, but I think this applies to every field. You know, like, every field you get ahead if people like you. Every field it's important to be able to, you know, work with people and get them to want to do what you say and all of that. But I wonder how it's separate from just, like, those, like, social skills and emotional intelligence, you know, like, because part of, like, the biggest feedback people give in medicine is, like, read the room, you know, like, pay attention and know when to shut up and when is okay to ask a question.
Absolutely.
And when you're being annoying and, you know, when the resident can teach you, you know, like, just pay attention.
This reminds me of, like, helping my father fix things when I was a child. My father's a lovely man, but he would get very impatient when trying to fix things. And I can understand this because sometimes it doesn't go well. And then you have a 10-year-old like hanging around going, what's that? What's this? Oh, can I help? Can I help? Can I help? Daddy, what are you doing? Daddy. And finally, my father's like, I'm like, okay. You know, so this is part of the learning process for me.
So you're saying the annoying people didn't get yelled at as kids?
I don't know.
Basically.
Or I wonder if this bad, what is it? Bad essence? Bad
I like that essence.
That effect, if that correlates to people with like low emotional intelligence or lower social skills, I wonder if it correlates, if it's secretly kind of the same thing.
I would suspect that that is true. Yeah.
Dave, did you ever get yelled at for not holding the light in the correct position?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Your analogy is reminding me of like the classic med student in surgery.
Yeah.
Where the med student's like, what's this? What are you doing? Why'd you do that? What do you do next? Can I hold this? Can I like get in here? You know, like, and they're just like, back off.
Sounds like a bad med student.
And then they're like, your one job is to suction. Why aren't you suctioning? Suction.
And you're like, I don't know. You yelled at me to get out of the way.
One of my interactions with a person that comes to mind and like the social awareness is this memory of being in a class in a computer lab, and they chose to sit right next to me. And at one point they turn to their left, which is a side I'm on, and they sneeze on my hand. And they don't acknowledge it.
What?
They don't say sorry. Like, they just sneeze on my hand and go back to their statistics.
Oh, dear.
And I made sure to never sit by them again. I wasn't confident enough to address it. I just went and washed my hands and came back and got my work done. I didn't want to deal with it. I'd already had enough run-ins with this person. It was only spring semester of freshman year.
That's the kind of thing, though. I mean, recognize when you've made a mistake, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we all make mistakes. I mean, I know, like, what was it? Just the other day, you know, I had yet another brilliant idea. I always joke that I'm so full of good ideas about how to improve medical education, but nobody ever thinks they're good ideas, you know? So I was walked into somebody's office. I think it was Matt Edwards. And I was like, Matt, I've got a great idea. Let me tell you all about it. And at some point, I can't remember what he said, but he said something that to me was like, I have things to do, Dave. And so at that moment, I was like, oh, I wonder how long I've been here.
Unwanted.
Unwanted. So as I left, I cracked a joke about, I basically said, you know, I'm sorry I took up your time kind of thing, and cracked a joke as I left, and he laughed, and hopefully that diffused the situation. But the point is that, you know, it's possible to make mistakes. That's fine. Hopefully, if you have the humility to admit that you screwed up, that you sneezed on the hand of the person next to you.
Like, if you recognize how socially inappropriate you were, it's not as bad.
Right. Because you're going to make them. You're going to make mistakes.
I'd bet to say that that person that sneezed on your hand didn't even know what was, like, socially acceptable or not. If they're just...
Or they were trying to get back at you.
I mean, my first interaction with them.
Yeah, who's the asshole?
I went.
Yeah, you didn't give us whole story.
I went on so right when I got to college, I went for band camp and we had an evening activity. So I went on a walk with who is my best friend now. And this person decides that they're coming on the walk with us too, except they're on the phone talking to somebody. So they're trailing like 10 feet behind us, talking on the phone, telling them that they're going on a walk with some people from band.
Red flag.
We're walking ahead of them like, oh, what's going on? Like, we didn't ask them to come. They're saying they're with us. And then once their call ends, our conversation just kind of dies and they try to join in. And we're just like,
again,
okay,
another
we're done walking.
Another cue.
I feel like I'm just like an anxious person. So I like kind of always watch how like people are responding to me. And therefore, if I pick up on signals that I'm annoying them or this is not a good time, I quiet down very quickly. And some people, I guess, just like don't.
Yeah.
Get it. But I think maybe that's part of being like the teachable and like noticing thing, which being teachable is a big skill.
Yeah.
That I didn't realize until I came to med school. You know, like being able to learn and institute feedback is something that a lot of people can't do, which is probably part of this because I've asked a question at the wrong time. I've been told that now is not the time by a resident, but then you just like learn the pattern of, oh, don't do that again.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Again, you know, the cues sometimes are hard to read depending on the situation. And so, you know, I learned that dad under the sink means shut up and watch. You know, you learned that whatever situation you were in with that resident or in that situation, you know, probably there are better times to to ask questions or contribute your observations or whatever. But I, you know, like I want this to not be important, you know, like I want this to not be important, but my gut says that it's important, you know, and I think probably 99% of people who get into medical school, you know, have already have some facility at this, but I think it's possible that I don't know if 99% is the right. Okay, what the hell? Well, just a number of people who get into medical, a high number of people who get into medical school already have this unlock, but that can't be true for everybody. And so I just thought it would be, you know, good to talk about, you know, because the stakes are kind of high, right? I mean, I don't know what the actual number is, but I suspect that, you know, let's say 99% of medical students eventually match. Okay. And it will cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars in education to achieve that. And there are no guarantees that even if you get to the point where you're ready to match, that you will match. And in fact, if you aren't successful in the first try, you have to wait. You know, all the things that we talked about earlier in the show will happen. Would you even want to take the chance?
I think if you go a little bit further, you can think about the responsibility that a physician will have in the future.
Yeah.
And I know that sometimes it's a little bit easy to not think about it, but really, essentially, what you're going to be doing later on is you're going to have to take care of another human being, and you have to be willing to work under a high pressure situation. And you have to be okay with, for example, if you do something wrong, getting corrected. If you do something that you weren't supposed to do, getting corrected, receiving feedback, because it's such a high stakes profession.
Yeah. And of course also that, you know, even if matching isn't, you know, a problem for you, you're still going to have to interact with people and be a part of their lives. And would you rather, you know, for instance, patients seek you out if they need your help, or would you rather them be like, oh, that sucked, I'm going to go? Or, you know, would you like knowing that your professional colleagues at least tolerate working with you, you know, like, or instead of avoiding you, like, anyway.
Another question I just thought of, like, is how quickly does that effective presence come out? Like, if you have
Very quickly.
So if you have a 15-minute appointment with a patient, are they going to not like you instantly?
See, what I was thinking about is, what if you have a 15-minute residency interview?
Yeah, that too. Or yeah. Like over Zoom too.
Yeah. I think it comes fairly quickly, but, you know, my guess is, from my own sort of feeling about this, my guess is that there is a sort of a process of confirming that idea.
Like, the person interviewing you or the patient shouldn't be so quick to judge you.
Right. I don't think anybody's going to immediately shut down, yeah. but people form their ideas pretty quickly.
Right.
Actually, I think in residency interviews, that's exactly what they're trying to do.
That's like the goal, isn't it?
I was like, their main purpose is, do I like this person? You know, like, they don't care anymore about scores or all the activities on your app or your personal statement, because they've all reviewed all that and decided they liked it enough to offer you an interview. So the interview is pretty much exclusively about, do I want to work with you? If I am I'm on a night shift with you at 2 a.m., are you the type of person I want to talk with? Or am I going to want to just, like, bang my head against the wall because you won't shut up? Or, like, I don't like you and blah, blah, blah. And so, like, I think that's exactly the purpose of residency interviews, which is a little scary.
So let's say we're saying that 15 minutes is not enough. I mean, what time frame would be enough? You know, so, I mean, if somebody doesn't get a good feeling about you within 20, 30 minutes, do you want them to spend a couple days with you, a couple weeks?
No.
I think that's kind of like the OA rotation argument.
Yes.
That gives you more chance to meet more people for a longer period of time, for better or for worse. You know, like, it could work either way for you.
But less is more if you have this problem.
If you're annoying. But, like, for residency interviews, I think whether they're Zoom or in person, they're usually about 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Some of the longer ones are like 30, but, like, so they've clearly decided that that's enough for them to decide if the interview changes how they view you. Like, I think for some people, it's like, wow, I really liked this person, I'm going to move them even higher up. Or sometimes it's like, wow, I really didn't move them down. Or sometimes you stay the same. But
so, you know, I guess the question is, what can you even do about this? I mentioned, like, you know, coaching, ask a mentor, all this kind of stuff. You know, I think you've got to figure out what it is that you're good at and what it is that you need help with. I mean, one of the things that I know that I need help with is that I would imagine that sometimes my jokey, you know, personality is like, shut up, Dave.
I've never really thought that, to be honest.
Well, the context here is important.
Oh, in other situations than the podcast.
But, you know, if you're trying to get something serious done and there's Dave Etler in the corner cracking his little jokes, you know, I can imagine. And the other thing that I do that I'm pretty sure is detrimental, but I'm not sure that I care, is I'm a bit self-effacing. And this can be a turnoff, I know. Mm. I've heard people on the show say, you know, that they were told that they were too self-effacing and that it was kind of a problem. Because, you know, it gives people the idea that you are, in fact, an ineffectual bumbling dodo. Puts that in their head for them. And the truth is that is a self-defense mechanism. Hello. That's a self-defense mechanism for, you know, like heading people off. So it's best not to do too much of that, in my opinion. One author and the proprietor of smalltalkscience.com says that the best personalities are humble, caring, and unselfish. Positive, enthusiastic, goal-oriented, and compassionate, playful, and flexible. I can buy that.
That's a lot to live up to.
All just like likable characteristics.
Yeah. And I would add, and I think Holly said this before in the show, I would add that some of those encompass the important skill of learning when to leave the room, to stop talking, and to recede in the background. Mm. You know, flexibility, for instance, unselfish, caring. Those are two things that I think link up with this skill of being like, you know what, I'm going to shut up now.
I think, you know, being able to recognize you're not the center of the universe is always important, you know?
Yeah.
That, like, sometimes other things take priority over you. And I think one thing that Nicole pointed out like when you interpret silence as they hate you, is I really did that a lot as a med student too. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started being like the more advanced student on rotations where I started to realize, like, you've just got a lot going on, like, the closer you get to resident. And it's mm-hmm. not that you dislike the student or they're doing bad or you hate them. Sometimes you just, like, forget. You get distracted doing all your other stuff. Yeah. And it's the anxious student that projects, like, this must be bad onto them, which happens a lot. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess I say to try and save students from doing exactly what it sounds like we all do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, part of the problem in that situation is that you're expected to put yourself out there, right? You're told, mm-hmm. I've said on the show, you know, if you don't talk, nobody's going to know what you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of a conflict there. I understand that. But again, read the room.
I'm still curious whether this effective presence is the same in person or virtually, because with people with negative presence, I've always felt just like zapped and drained the moment they come around. Mm. And it's almost like an energy they bring to the room. But does that same energy come when they're across the screen? Because, like, we've used the term when they walk into the room. Like, when I sign into the room, do I bring that same feeling to people? Don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I feel like you would have to be super strong if they're sitting there, like, I don't know, I guess their mic might not be off. Maybe they're unmuted. Maybe that's...
I wonder if at that point... If you already see this person in that way, then mm-hmm. every little thing they do is annoying to you. So if you already see somebody from personal interactions, like one-on-one or in public, then you see them virtually, you're going to overanalyze every little mm-hmm. thing they do, and it'll just be more annoying.
I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. It feeds on itself.
I think the only experience I have to draw on, I guess, is like the Zoom interviews, because I had to do a bunch of them with people I've never met before. And there was definitely ones where I connected really well with the interviewer and I felt like they were going super great. And I really liked the person. But then I definitely had some really awkward, awful ones that I was like looking at the clock, like, how many minutes do I have to like try and keep going with this?
What if your interviewer has a negative effective presence?
How did they get to that position?
That's a problem. That's a problem. Because you're also trying to judge. I mean, the other part of residency interviews is you're trying to judge them.
Like, it's all about fit, which I'm hoping, like, no matter what your presence is, you're supposed to find the people who like you and want you. Yeah. Like, that's the whole point. So hopefully you just find that.
I don't know if this was true or not, but didn't they say that during some med school interviews, they would purposely try to have like a negative presence to see how you could alter that presence? I don't know if that was
ever
true.
We're getting into
I feel like I had that at one school.
Now we're getting into some psyops bullshit right here.
When I interviewed at one med school, you know, 4 years ago or whatever it was now, I was in the interview room and all of the lights shut off halfway through my interview and like wouldn't come back on. And I remember being like, is this a test? Like, I respond to adversity, if that counts, or just like unexpected stuff.
You know, one thing that I appreciate with awkward people is that, you know, I've known some weird people in my time here and in my life. And I think the ones that I love the most are the ones who knew that they were weird. I remember one person even thanked me once for sincerely for pointing out a faux pas and seemed genuinely grateful for the feedback, which I found super endearing and made me love that person even more. So I think it's possible to be awkward and have trouble reading the room, but also be somebody people want to be around. I genuinely liked being around this person, even though I worried about them.
And maybe those are the people that I would worry about on like a quick interview. Like takes them getting to know them to find them endearing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is the key. Like, display sincerity, self-awareness, humility. Those are the three things that I think could take the curse off an otherwise problematic, effective presence.
Some of my favorite friends have what I call like a really strong sense of self, which I think is what you're getting at, where they know that they're a weirdo, but that's who they are, and they don't make any apologies for it, and that's who they are, and they still, you know, don't want to irritate people, but this is just who they are. And so sometimes I really like those people too.
Yeah. Making the effort, I think, is important too, you know, like, you know, it, to the extent that you are aware of a problem, if you do nothing to ameliorate that problem, and that's obvious to the people who know you, maybe that's kind of an issue. I think one problem I have with this thought, and that you've sort of touched on, Holly, is that if I argue that you should focus on the ideas, am I saying you aren't great just the way you are? Is that a valid thing for me to say? I mean, I'm not saying that you suck. I'm saying that you have a choice, that you can be unapologetically awesome just the way you are and understand the consequences of that choice, or that there might be consequences for that choice. Or you can try to make changes that enable you to achieve something that you want to achieve. Both ideas are valid.
I feel like you can be unapologetically yourself and know that, and know that that makes you really great in a lot of situations. But I think that also takes awareness in which situations maybe some of your personality traits are not great.
Yeah.
You know, like that just like takes some awareness, because nobody's going to be perfectly suited for every situation.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that the reasons that I've stated about myself as being a problem are the reasons that I have never once been asked to help with med school interviews, even though I have offered.
What?
Because I think that they think I am going to sit there and crack jokes the whole time and just be not serious about it. When in fact, like, I believe that I can go in there and be completely serious and be completely professional about it. I just don't show them that side of me too often. I'm the least professional person.
You should offer to do a mock interview and they can see.
That's a good point.
Maybe it's they're worried you're just too nice of a guy that a really horrible student can interview with you and you just like won't write anything bad.
That's true. I've kind of made it known.
Take them all.
I've kind of made it known that I love everybody. And, you know, like,
you just said you wanted everybody to be happy. So
I want everybody to be happy. Everybody. You're in.
Apparently, Dave is the dove, and maybe I'm the hawk since I was the.
You and I should interview people together.
Yeah.
Together, good cop, bad cop.
The Holly, the Conger Etler team. Yeah.
For anyone who's listening, if the lights go out, it is a test.
Yeah. Make sure to just pretend it's not a big deal and keep going and be nonchalant and adaptable.
How would it go over if you're in one of those rooms with like the motion sensors and your lights go off and you just flail your arms a little bit and then pick up right where you left off? No acknowledging what just happened.
Whatever you gotta do, I don't know.
There's a special subgroup of personalities that I wanted to also address, which is people who don't suffer fools gladly. Students who don't suffer fools gladly. This is a problem because fools are everywhere. They are, you know, among the residents, they're among the attendings, they're among, you know, like those people are out there. And so I have some advice for those people who I have also loved. Never let them see you roll your eyes.
Wait, can you explain, go back a little bit, what do you mean by fools?
I.e., you don't like what somebody is doing or how they approach the world or how they think about the world.
Okay.
And so you're a fool. And so basically, if I thought that Emma Barr.
We have to clarify which one.
Camera here. If I thought that Emma Barr, yes. If I thought that you, Emma Barr, were a dumbass, but you were like my resident.
Okay.
Or my attending or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people out there I have known who find it difficult to conceal that sort of emotion, that mm-hmm. sort of frustration or annoyance. So that's what I say, like, you don't suffer fools gladly. And if you can, if you let them see you roll your eyes, did I say that right? If you let them see you roll your eyes, then they're going to know that you think that they're foolish.
Okay.
And that's not good. Decide if you have to speak up. There are dangerous situations and ethical issues and things like that, HR problems, you know, things like that, that you, you know, might reasonably think that you should speak up about. And again, you should know the consequences if you do that, especially if the person is of a higher status. So if that's what you're going to do, whoever you talk to about this, whether it's that person or somebody that has control over that person or something, give your feedback with sensitivity and love, or don't give it at all. That's my advice. Figure out how to say it so that people will deal with the situation in a constructive manner. Offer a solution with feedback, offer a solution with the feedback. Or if you don't know what that solution is, at least say that, like, I don't know what to do about this. Maybe you have ideas.
So is the person who rolled their eyes the one that's...
I've clearly confused, used a confusing turn of phrase.
Yeah, I haven't heard that phrase before.
Is the one who's rolling their eyes the one who's also giving the feedback?
Yes.
Okay. I follow you now.
So I guess the point is, like, if you see something that is truly a problem, dangerous mm-hmm. situations, ethical issues, HR problems, things that are like serious situations that should be addressed, offer your feedback with love and sensitivity while knowing that there could be consequences. And if you can't live with those consequences, then you have to make a decision on, you know, whether to speak up or not. But mm-hmm. the point is, give your feedback, sensitivity and love, step back, consider your job done.
Yeah.
You know? And then wipe that look of contempt off your face, because that's over.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like it's hard to tell whether it's like just a personality thing or like what they said or did was actually like something concerning. So like when I've been in that situation, go to like a third party and be like, does this sound, you know, concerning to you? I don't know.
I just wipe my nose on camera. I'm so cool. Anyway. Those are my thoughts.
I feel like I was trying to remember when you said the rolling eyes thing. I think I've gotten in trouble for rolling my eyes at somebody.
You and your eyes.
I know. My eyes and my eyebrows. Such a problem.
Those are the only two things we could see about you lately.
I know. I can't remember the example.
I think being able to give, like, quote unquote, negative feedback is also a tremendously undervalued skill, because I think a lot of people just like won't ever do it, which is a problem, you know, because if no one ever tells you anything you're not doing well or could do better, then you never know what to work on.
Yeah.
Hopefully they deliver it in a constructive way. Yeah. Two-way
you have to do the positive sandwich thing. Like something positive, then the constructive, and then more positive. So hopefully you leave them with a good
Like, feeling. I really like the way you do X, but you killed that patient. But good job on that form.
Good job on the death certificate.
All right. That's our show. Albert, Emma, Holly, Nicole, thanks for being on the show today with me. Thanks for putting up with my harebrained ideas, Holly especially.
I want people to be happy too. I just also want the patients to be safe. So I was pointing out the concern.
Whatever. And what kind of gangrenous gallbladder would I be if I didn't thank you, Shortcoats, for making us part of your week? If you're new here and you like what you heard today, subscribe to our show wherever fine podcasts are available. Our editors, they're AJ Chowdhury and Eric Bozart. Alex Belzer is our marketing coordinator. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College Medicine Student Government and ongoing support from the Writing and Humanities Program. Thank you, Writing and Humanities Program. Love those guys. Our music is by Dr. Vox and Catmosphere. Don't let the bastards get you down. Talk to you in 1 week.